Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with Berklee Symphony Executive Director Renee Mandel about this week's final concert of the Berklee Symphony season, featuring the music of Dmitri Shostakovich, his massive Babi Yar Symphony No. 13. Choreographer Trey McIntyre talks about Smuin Ballet's Dance Series 2, which features a world premiere tribute to the 50th anniversary of the Summer of Love. You'll also hear about The Encounter at the Curran, conceived, starring, and directed by Simon McBurney. Just four more performances left to catch that performance. Stay with us. Let's start things off on a musical note here on Open Air with a discussion of a partnership that's been going on for some time now, that with the Berklee Symphony. And its executive director, Renee Mandel, joins me in studio to talk about that unique partnership. Hey, Renee, thanks for taking some time today.
Thank you very much for having me, David.
Especially on a day which is the very performance of the last concert of the series, Babi Yar, tonight at 8 o'clock. It's a big work that we'll talk about in just a moment. But first, let's just talk a minute about our partnership, which goes way back. I think thanks to the initiative of my partner in radio, it helped form my own way of doing things here on KLW, and who I succeeded as host of Open Air, Alan Farley, initiated this series some time ago, back when Kent Nagano was music director of the symphony.
That's right.
And this is a unique partnership.
Yes.
We should say so, in the very least.
Yes. No, we are extremely pleased with this partnership. It's quite rare that an orchestra gets an opportunity to have all of their concerts performed on the air in their local radio affiliates. And so we're extremely grateful for this.
The way it originally worked back when Alan was hosting was the concerts, as you know very well, you have four concerts a year, and we used to broadcast them a couple of weeks after each of the performances. Mm-hmm. And so that led to a kind of spotty appearance, a radio presence of the Berklee Symphony. And then I had the idea of grouping them all together for the month of May, so we have week after week a strong presence of getting a sense of what our Berklee Symphony is all about. And I think that's worked rather well.
It has. It's our own Berklee Symphony May Festival.
Mm. So let's talk about the way we, just this past Monday, we broadcast that first concert, which had Edwin Outwater as guest conductor for Paul Drescher's premiere, a guy who's had a long career and partnership with the Berklee Symphony as well.
Indeed. Indeed. We performed one of the first pieces that Joanna Carnero, our music director, performed with Berklee Symphony was his piece Cornucopia. And we then commissioned a work of his for quadricord, that ginormous instrument that he did.
He built himself.
Oh,
yeah,
it was fantastic. And then we brought him back for another commission that was a straight orchestral commission. That was superb.
Mm-hmm. And he also often gives some of the pre-concert talks. Mm-hmm. And his own Drescher Ensemble has been an extraordinary presence, not only here on KLW, but he's really one of those Renaissance men of the Bay Area that we're so fortunate to have such a close relationship as well.
Extraordinary human being.
This coming Monday, we'll be broadcasting the performance from December, which featured the young Aleem Chan as guest conductor for the U.S. premiere of James McMillan's Symphony No. 4. How did that symphony come about? I understand there was something to do with Donald Runicles.
Well, it was. It was a co-commission with the BBC Scottish National Orchestra and the Pittsburgh Symphonies. It was written in honor of Donald Runicles, I believe his 60th birthday.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
I wanted to say that. I always yes, and we commissioned it, co-commissioned it, as I said, with Pittsburgh and Scottish. They Pittsburgh was supposed to get the U.S. premiere of it, and we were going to have the West Coast premiere. Pittsburgh went on strike. So their misfortune was our fortune. We got the U.S. premiere of that work.
How did you come across Aleem Chan as a guest conductor?
She'd come to my attention through some mutual associates and some musicians, and she has been having this meteoric rise, and she came to us, and she was extraordinary. She is she was Gergiev's assistant in London, and she just took Berkeley by storm.
That concert will also feature Shai Wozner for piano soloist and Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 4 in G major. And then on the 15th of May, we'll be broadcasting the January concert, which had as its title Relevance, with Christian Reif, who makes two appearances as guest conductor this season. One for this broadcast on the 15th with the great Mason Bates, a good friend, who you're doing his cello concerto with Joshua Roman as cellist, and Beethoven's Fourth Symphony. And Mason Bates, another local mm-hmm. treasure. How did you manage to grab him for this?
Well, we found out about the cello concerto, the premiere of it that occurred over the last couple of years with, I think, Seattle Symphony and the LA Chamber Orchestra. And so we wanted to bring it to Berkeley, and that's what happened. And it was our good luck to bring it here.
Nice. And Mason's such a sweetheart.
Yes, he is.
We hope to have a segment with him as part of that broadcast on Monday, May 15th, featuring his cello concerto. We're talking about an overview of this full Berkeley Symphony season with Renee Mandel, the executive director of the symphony. That brings us to tonight's concert of Shostakovich, Babi Yar, Symphony No. 13. But before we do, I think we need to spend a couple of minutes to talk about the season of juggling that you've had on your hands. Why do we have Christian Reif as a guest conductor twice? Why do we have Aleem Chan as a guest conductor and Edwin Outwater as well when we're being billed as the Berkeley Symphony with Joanna Carnero? Perhaps you could enlighten us as to the chain of events that happened here.
Well, there's a very, very good and unusual reason for that, and that is that Joanna had been pregnant most of the season with triplets and gave birth to her triplets in January.
Fantastic. So we have this trio of conductors
that
were able to step in to help you manifest and realize the full Berkeley Symphony. Good for you for having those people on hand and at the ready. And what a spectacular job they've been doing.
Indeed.
So it brings us to this incredible work. So much to talk about this massive work, Dmitri Shostakovich, Babi Yar. What concerns me, though, Renee, is that, as it, I think, should your board of directors, is how it came to be that this Russian composer infiltrated the very core of the Berkeley Symphony operation and is the only composer represented at this concert. Now, I'm assuming there's an email trail that can be followed here.
Yeah. Well,
did this happen before or after the election?
That is correct. I would give credit for this not only to Joanna Carnero, but also to Bill Quillen, who had been working for us as our wonderful development director last season. Bill happens to have a doctorate in Russian music history, and said we ought to do Shostakovich 13, and I pounced on that and brought it to Joanna, and then she leapt on it, and this is how it came to pass. Mm.
Well, in fact, there's all kinds of controversy around the first performance back in 1962. It's right out of a John Le Carré intrigue mm-hmm. when it comes down to it. The singer soloist who we have Denis Sedov for the Berkeley Symphony performances back in 1962, that was Boris Gemira, who withdrew from the premiere under pressure from the Communist Party. Even the conductor, Yevgeny Mravinsky, soon followed suit, though he excused himself for other than political reasons. Mm-hmm. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Joanna Carnero's in the other reasons excuse as well, juggling
with
triplets.
That's right.
Now, we have to talk about why this is such a controversial work. Shostakovich then asked Kirill Kondrashin to conduct the work, and then two singers were engaged, just in case, right? So further intrigue, Viktor Nechepailo was to sing the premiere with Vitaly Gromadsky in case a substitute was needed. Nechepailo happened to need to drop off in order to cover a Bolshoi Theater production of Verdi's Don Carlo. And in fact, he was ordered to get sick.
Right, exactly.
It's amazing that there were so many roadblocks to making this happen. So let's talk about the work itself and what it is all about.
Well, Yevtushenko went to visit Babi Yar back in 1960-61, and he was so moved by what he experienced that he was appalled that there was no monument, there was nothing there marking what had happened.
Well, let's back up just a moment to let people know where Babi Yar was. It's a ravine in Ukraine.
Kiev.
In Ukraine, Kiev, Ukraine, where the Nazis massacred Jews by the thousands.
34,000.
Amazing. In September of 1941, which at that time was the largest massacre of the Holocaust to date.
2 days, 34,000. And then over the year, another 100, up to about 150,000 of Russians, Ukrainians, Jews, Gypsies, and undesirables in the eyes of the Nazis.
So the symphony takes on some rather heady topics, and Shostakovich, in fact, expands it beyond Babi Yar to include all forms of denunciation of anti-Semitism, especially in this first movement, citing not only Babi Yar, but also the Bialystok pogrom, the Dreyfus Affair, even Anne Frank coming into play, using the poetry of Yevgeny Yevtushenko throughout. What do you know about Yevtushenko and the work of...
Well, when he wrote the poem, it was published in a newspaper, and Shostakovich wrote it, and Shostakovich had a very deep affinity for the Judaism, and he was appalled by anti-Semitism, and so he read this and was also deeply moved by it. And one day Yevtushenko gets a call, and his wife answers, and the person on the line says, this is Dmitry Shostakovich, I'd like to speak with Mr. Yevtushenko. And she thought it was a joke, and he gets on the phone, and sure enough, it's Shostakovich. And he asked if he could write a symphony to his poem. And Yevtushenko said, well, of course. And Shostakovich said, okay, well, I already did, so can we come over and look at it?
Fantastic.
Then he went ahead and took four more poems and essays of Yevtushenko's, and then made an entire five-movement symphony out of it.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that first movement of Babi Yar, the Symphony No. 13 by Dmitri Shostakovich, and then more with Renee Mendel, executive director of the show. We are in our pledge drive here at KLW, so the number to call during this segment of Shostakovich is 800-525-9917. And then more with Renee Mendel. Stay with us. Кажется, что Дрейфус — это я. Just a touch of the first movement of Symphony No. 13 in B-flat minor, Baba Yar. Some of the text that you just heard in the Russian, over Baba Yar, there are no monuments. The steep precipice is like a crude gravestone. I am terrified. I am as old today as all Jewish people. Now I imagine that I'm a Jew. Here I wander through ancient Egypt, and here, on the cross, crucified, I perish. And still I have on me the marks of the nails. I imagine myself to be Dreyfus, the Philistine, my informer and judge. I am behind bars. I am surrounded, persecuted, spat on, slandered. Some heady stuff indeed, Renee, but so important to have come out. And how brave of Shostakovich, himself a fairly persecuted man by the party, to just be so insistent on this coming out.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. He was not, although he lived in fear constantly, he had a tremendous amount of courage to not back away from that. And his music, I was just talking to somebody the other day that the older I get, the more, for lack of a better word, awesome his music is to me. We program a considerable amount of it, and there's no wonder that actually Shostakovich happens to be among the most popular composers with classical music audiences these days.
In that excerpt, we heard Arthur Eisen bass with the Moscow Philharmonic Orchestra, Kondrashin himself conducting on that. How did we come across the soloist for this performance?
Well, he came to my attention actually through a friend of mine. We were looking for clearly a very, very strong bass. There aren't too many who can sing this role effectively, and we particularly wanted a Russian. And so when he came to our attention, I immediately contacted his agent, and he was available, and here he is, straight from St. Petersburg.
Denis Yadov, fantastic setup, by the way. Wonderful sound that we'll hear tonight at 8 o'clock at Zellerbach Hall here in Berkeley, and a 7 o'clock pre-talk, is that correct?
That is. It's with Richard Taruskin, Dr. Richard Taruskin, and our own William Bill Quillen. And Marika Kuzma.
Before we talk a little bit about the second movement and wrap up about Shostakovich, let's talk a little bit about, again, the partnership that makes this kind of conversation possible on local public radio, mm-hmm. and a number for people to call, which is 800-525-9917. To show your support for this kind of in-depth conversation, not just a soundbite.
That is correct. Public radio, without public radio, we would not have the arts as we have it, not just classical music, but all the arts in our community. Number one champion is public radio, and KLW particularly is probably the best friend that Bay Area has for this sort of thing.
We're happy to have that partnership continue. And again, we're broadcasting the entire season of the Berkeley Symphony during the month of May at 9 p.m. on Monday evenings. Tonight's performance, if you can't come live to Zellerbach Hall, will be heard on Monday, May 22nd at 9 p.m. You'll hear that full performance. And again, all of the Berkeley Symphony performances heard week after week here on local public radio. 800-525-9917 to show your support for local public radio and the arts coverage that only you'll hear on KLW with this kind of depth. Warts and all, you know, I'll make mistakes during open air, as you well know, listeners, if you've been listening to me for a while. We lack a certain degree of polish. We don't care that much that it's a pristine sound, that you can hear a pin drop as you can from a produced show at NPR. That's what makes it real. We're real people here, and we appreciate the fact that we can have that kind of spontaneity.
Thank you, David. That makes me feel really good.
Well, Rene, you do your own juggling in your own way to make this entire Berklee Symphony season happen without Joanna Carneiro, and we're appreciative of that. Let's just talk a little bit about the second movement. Now, this whole symphony has some heady stuff going on indeed, yet the second movement uses a certain amount of sardonic humor, which uses the poet's writing and spirit of mockery that is kind of denounces these, well, what has historically been these efforts of tyrants to just shackle wit and shackle the people's will, not simply light or humorous, but in this kind of barbed way and parody way, which Shostakovich knew so well and was so good at expressing, given his own suppression and his hyper-scrutinization by the Soviet authorities. Worth a whole series of show on Shostakovich. I wish we could, speaking of it in depth, this is a little bit more depth than you'll hear anywhere else, but still, it's just a surface look. Now, in that second movement, talking about the suppression of the Soviet people in general, as well as letting things out, you'll hear texts from the soloist and the chorist. Tsars, kings, emperors, rulers of the world commanded parades, but humor they could not. To the palaces of the eminent, who well-groomed all day declined, came the vagabond Aesop, and before him all appeared impoverished, in homes where the hypocrite left traces of his puny feet, not puny hands, by the way, puny feet. And this banality, Haj Nasser ed-Din swept aside with his jokes like a chessboard. Let's hear part of that second movement of Shostakovich's Baba Yar, Symphony No. 13. Thank you so much for coming in, Rene. We wish you a spectacular performance tonight and planning for the next season, which I'm sure we'll hear about soon.
You will hear about it very soon.
We'll have you back on to talk about that.
Thank you very much, David.
During this next segment of the Shostakovich here on KLW, we're going to offer you tickets. See, we're doing things as usual. We're offering free tickets, even though we're in our pledge drive. While we encourage you to make that donation at our website or through our 800 number, I'm asking you now to call a local number, 415-841-4134. If you'd like to be in the audience tonight for this symphony that was suppressed in the Soviet Union, Khrushchev himself tried to make this music not heard. He was angered by Yushchenko's poetry. But even some fighters on the musical front perked up. See, Shostakovich had proven himself untrustworthy once more. Let's get him. And they just started a disgusting poison campaign. They tried to scare everyone away from Yevtushenko and himself. This performance, by the way, it was effectively banned in the Soviet bloc. The work's premiere in East Berlin occurred only because the local censor had forgotten to clear the performance with Moscow beforehand. 415-841-4134. If you'd like to hear this performance tonight in Zellerbach Hall, we have four pairs of tickets, 415-841-4134. So after this Soviet block of accidental performance in East Berlin, a copy of the score with the original text was smuggled out to the West. Can you imagine this today? Something, an artwork being smuggled and being banned by the people, the nation that had fostered it and fostered such a spirit. And it was premiered here in 1970 by the Philadelphia Orchestra under Eugene Ormandy. So some of this second movement of the Symphony No. 13, 415-841-4134, if you'd like to be a part of the Zellerbach Hall audience as we hear music of Shostakovich here on Open Air.
Властители всей земли, ко командовали парадами. Ой, юмором не могли, не могли. Дворцы именитых особ, все дни возлежащих выхолено, являлся бродяга Эзоп, и нищими они выглядели.
Являлся бродяга Эзоп, и нищими они выглядели.
В домах, где ханжа насветил своими ногами щуплыми, всю пошлость хаджана средин шибал, как шахматы шутками.
Всю пошлость хаджана средин шибал, как шахматы шутками.
Some of the sardonic power of Dmitri Shostakovich. Mortic?
One pair.
That you can hear tonight at Zellerbach Hall, 415-841-4134. If you're interested in a complimentary pair of tickets to this massive work that was banned in East Berlin until they forgot to censor it. Good afternoon, David LaTulipe with you here for Open Air here on local public radio, KALW, here during our May membership campaign, offering you as much of the program as possible, fully intact, as they say. And here's another invitation for you to catch not only the spectacularly renovated Curran Theater on Geary Street, but to experience the sights and sounds of the Amazon rainforest as well. The Encounter tells the true story of National Geographic photojournalist Lauren McIntyre, who was lost in a remote area of Brazil in 1969 and discovered a remarkable culture. It's a solo performance by Simon McBurney, who also self-directed the production, which originally premiered in 2015 at the Edinburgh International Festival before its sold-out success at London's Barbican, which was followed by a European tour and an opening on Broadway this past September. Simon McBurney is a multi-Olivier Award-winning, Tony and SAG Award-nominated actor, writer, director, and one of Europe's most original theater makers. He's co-founder and artistic director of Complicit, Britain's most innovative theater company, so says The New Statesman and others. His work, from site-specific installations to opera, new writing, and the reimagining of classic texts, continuously resist any kind of standard definition once you've experienced them. You could have witnessed his work in New York with Al Pacino for The Resistible Rise of Arturo Yu, or at Lincoln Center with the Emerson String Quartet and the music of Shostakovich. He is also a prolific film, television, and radio actor, starring many major movies, including The Theory of Everything, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, Harry Potter and the Deadly Hallows, The Last King of Scotland, as well as in Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation. Simon, welcome to KALW and our airwaves.
That was quite a mouthful.
It was, and my goodness, thank you for taking time. I mean, you're performing tonight.
I would just say it's Arturo Uy.
Okay, thank you.
It's an appropriate text by Bertolt Brecht right now. It's about it's The Resistible Rise of a Demagogue, and how we all get kind of sucked into a rather simplistic rhetoric which we choose to believe, and then disaster follows.
So wax philosophic about that right now.
I think there's going to be a revival pretty soon. I can tell you that much.
Did I at least get the name of your company right? Is it
Complicité? Complicité, like complicity.
I didn't see the accent.
Complicity. Complicité. Yeah, Complicité. The reason why it had a French name was that I trained in France, and when I created the company, I thought, well, I knew that the French wouldn't respond to my touring in their country with a company that had an English name, and I knew that the English didn't really care. So we ended up with a French name, and then once we started to become pretty successful, then it became difficult to get rid of it. But complicity means partnership in an evil action, but there's always a sort of sense of illegality. In the French, it actually has a double meaning, whereby it's really being in partnership with people. So the idea is, at the beginning, was simply that we are constantly kind of theatre terrorists, but we drag the audience in league with us as we, in whatever we create.
Well, naturally, we're going to be talking about The Encounter, but since we're on the subject of complicité, what are you percolating right now?
Well, excuse me.
Live radio.
That's it. In the last few years, we've done a number of different pieces, from a creation of The Master and Margarita by Bulgakov through to a piece about mathematics and the great Indian mathematician called Ramanujan. And I suppose we are constantly, as a company, looking to push the edges of things, not in terms, just for the sake of it, not in terms of the form of the piece, but really in terms of how we communicate what are urgent and contemporary issues, which, I mean, in general, they're things which obsess me. The questions of where we are in this world, what is happening to this world, how do we communicate with each other? And things, as I say, you know, when we took the piece about Ramanujan, it was the fact that I was so hopeless at mathematics at school that I thought, I want to understand what it's about. In a sense, this piece, The Encounter at the Current, is also a kind of exploration. It is almost an excavation, if you like, of a text. And I heard you saying earlier, yes, it's about the Amazon rainforest. Well, it is set there, and yes, it is about the Mayaruna people, and it is about Lauren McIntyre. This was a photojournalist, very famous in the National Geographic, remarkable pictures he took, but this incident was an incident that he told nobody for 20 years, where he got lost for 3 months in a very remote area of Peru, encountered a people who were essentially trying to escape our so-called civilization, the encroachment by oil prospectors, drug runners, loggers, and so on, and were, as most tribal peoples in the Amazon are today, encountering extreme violence and brutality and the seizing of their lands and the destruction of their culture.
So was this a native people that that absented themselves from society?
Well, the Mayaruna were part of a group called the Matisse, which is a large large grouping of different tribes, and they live in an area of the Amazon around the Javari Valley on the border with Peru, where even today Survival International, which is an organization that works for the rights of indigenous people all over the world, reckon there to be probably still in 2017 anything up to 30 or 40 indigenous groups who are out of contact, who have never had any contact whatsoever with the Western world, with white people. And they continue to live as they've always lived. And now, of course, instead of suggesting that people get in contact with them, the attitude is to try and protect their lands, allow them to carry on with their lives as they wish to live them, but if they want to come out, then of course to offer them suitable protection and stand up for their rights.
So how did you develop this concept? Did you come across the story in National Geographic?
There's a book, a remarkable book called Amazon Beaming by a man called Petru Popescu, who actually lives here on the West Coast, who encountered Lauren McIntyre back in the 1980s when he was on a trip in the Amazon. And he got talking to him and found him a very fascinating man. They started to talk about communication and how could the first people coming to America, South America, have communicated with the tribal people? How did they? Well, the suggestion was through sign language and very basic sort of ideas of pointing at things. And then McIntyre suddenly said to him, I think there's another way. And Petru Popescu said, well, what do you mean? And McIntyre began to tell him about this exchange of information that he'd had with this indigenous people, which was wordless communication. And this forms part of the story that he tells, which he didn't want to tell for 20 years because he felt he was a scientist. He was a materialist, as he called himself. And he thought that people would laugh at him at this experience. And finally, at the end of the 80s, they worked together, collaborated, and Petru produced this book called Amazon Beaming, which was his story, McIntyre's story, his obsession to find the source of the Amazon, which led him into this situation where he had contact with these people and where, indeed, he lost all his bearings. He lost his camera. He lost everything and remained very deep in the forest for 3 months until he came out through extraordinary circumstances, which is also part of the piece. Now, I would say that this story about a man lost in an alien environment, if you like, or an environment that he didn't know, of course, you say, well, is that the story of the theatre piece? Is that what the piece is about? And the answer is yes and no. Because essentially, once I had been given this book and I read it and I was fascinated, I didn't think really that it would make a piece of theatre. It was too complex. Mm. And it didn't even really feel necessarily that I had a right to tell this story. But as I have got older, the metaphor of the man lost and somehow adrift with the coordinates of his cultural landscape or where he is in this world, how does he situate himself, has become kind of more and more urgent to me. Mm. And in a sense, as an artist, I feel overwhelmed by the complexity of the world we live in and the direction in which we're headed. And trying to understand myself as an artist in the world led me to a very great interest in the way the brain works. So I made a piece about 15, 20 years ago called Mnemonic, about the way that memory works. That also was in New York and was on for in the year 2000, 2001 for many, many weeks. And in that piece, I became fascinated about the relationship between what we know about the brain, in other words, the biochemistry of the brain, and how we experience memory in everyday lives. And also, what is the relationship between memory and identity? Okay, all this talk that I'm doing on live radio now, how does this relate to the piece? Well, I continued my fascination with the brain, and I became interested in consciousness. How are we conscious? What does that even mean? You know, I'm conscious of talking into this radio now, people are conscious of listening, but how does all of that work? Is it just a set of firing synapses, or is there something more complex going on? And of course there is. The moment you think you can talk about consciousness, it sort of slips from your grasp and it becomes a very circular thing. But it has to do, of course, with the question of the way that we construct our world, the way that we live our life. And as I was pursuing my rather sometimes fruitless research into consciousness, meeting neuroscientists, psychologists, philosophers, people like Daniel Dennett, who wrote Consciousness Explained, and many extraordinary people, at the same time, I started rereading this book, Amazon Beaming. And I thought there's a connection between the two things. And I started to twist the two themes, if you like, together into a piece of sort of interlocking DNA. So there's more than one story going on. And the question came down to this fact. As I tell this story, how can I get inside the head of the audience so that they themselves have a physical sense of these questions that I'm posing here on the radio, which might seem like a kind of garbled, jumbled stream of consciousness, but how can that become something dramatic and physically interesting to people in
theater?
And that's
where we come into the sound design, of course. Gareth Fry.
Well, I would say it's not just Gareth Fry's sound design. It is the sound design of a large number of people. Gareth Fry technically realized it, but of course the content and the conception was a whole pool of us.
Mm-hmm.
So it is very much a collective thing. But the point was, I had this idea that if I could speak to people intimately, as I am doing now, in a microphone, which is something people are very familiar with, of course, since the birth of radio and then television, and now with the way that people listen to podcasts and so on. But if I could do that in a live environment, as I am doing now, looking in your eyes, something interesting is happening. Because I get inside your head in another way.
You're literally whispering in people's ears, aren't
That's
you?
Right. Uh-huh. And so I conceived of this idea that I wanted to speak through microphones and the whole audience would wear headphones. And I started to explore this and to see what would happen. And at the same time, I had this idea of using a binaural head, which is essentially sound as space. What do I mean by that? Well, when you wear headphones and you listen to the binaural head, you essentially hear what that head is hearing, as if you were that head. So in other words, if somebody appears behind you or a door opens behind you, you think that there really is a door opening behind you. You hear, you could say, in 3D. It's a little bit like VR, virtual reality, but for the ears. And so I wanted to explore this relationship between the hearing of that kind of reality, if you like, and a relationship with what you see. So on stage, the story takes place in the Amazon. It also takes place in my apartment in London with my daughter. It takes place, if you like, in multiple locations. And the question, if you like, constantly being posed of the audience is, as they're watching an empty stage and they're hearing something completely different, what happens in their brains? In other words, many people start to actually see the things that are not there. And they begin to ask themselves questions. They have physical sensations within their body, which, of course, question the nature of the way that they imagine, they're conscious of things, their perception of the world.
So much more than just the story of Lauren McIntyre, for
sure. Of course.
Just four more opportunities to catch it tonight at 7, tomorrow and Saturday at 8, Sunday at 2. It is The Encounter with the incredible Simon McBurney. It's at the Curran Theater. More information at sfcurran.com.
And it has just won a Tony Award.
Fantastic. Congratulations.
Yeah.
sfcurran.com. Thanks so much for coming in, Simon.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Smiwin Ballet's Dance Series 2 gets underway this Friday in Mountain View, and before its conclusion in Carmel on June 3rd, we'll offer performances in Walnut Creek and here in San Francisco, and at the Yerba Buena Center as well. Series 2 will include a new addition by Smiwin Dance dance specialist Nicole Haskins, called The Poetry of Being, set to a classical score by Tchaikovsky, and choreographer-in-residence Amy Seiwert's critically lauded Broken Open, set to music by world-renowned cellist and composer Julia Kent, who creates music using looped cello, found sounds, and electronics. It also marks the return of internationally acclaimed choreographer Trey McIntyre, who has produced more than 100 dance works and is the founder of the Trey McIntyre Project. Trey has produced more than 100 dance works, and the Trey McIntyre Project foundation is based in Boise, Idaho. Trey's contribution coincides with the Summer of Love, and his work is a celebration of that era's freedom of spirit, of unconventional rules of life and love, and especially the incredible music of that era, and is an exuberant display of athleticism and enthusiasm that are Trey's hallmark. I caught up with him earlier at the Academy of Ballet at 2121 Market Street. It's an address I've passed by many times without realizing the creative space and spirit that lies behind those doors. It's where the Smiwan dancers were rehearsing Trey's work, so you'll hear a bit of Market Street and the ambiance of an active rehearsal space. Trey, welcome to Open Air.
Thanks very much.
Your last Smiwan appearance was for Oh Inverted World. It was 2010, right?
That sounds right.
And did the critical reaction to that, because it was widely praised, result in a return invitation, or is there an ongoing relationship you have with Smiwan?
It's hard to know what instigated it. Celio approached me originally about making a piece to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Summer of Love, and it was right up my alley for a lot of different reasons. I tend to focus on pop music in my work. I think people often think it's as a way of being accessible, but actually it's the music that I really respond to, and it's the music I want to explore. I'm really interested in contemporary music, and I'm not so much into orchestral work that's contemporary, and so that's a natch for me. It was also an era that I listened to growing up. It's not my era, but it was the music I gravitated to more than the music of my time. And that with, really exploring what were the themes of that time and what did the Summer of Love actually mean. And what does that mean in a contemporary context? Because there's so many different connections that make a lot of sense right now.
Is it something about the contemporary pop music that you find the dancers are more comfortable dancing to, more relaxed maybe?
I don't think that there's anything specific to how the dancers respond to it. I mean, dancers are so adaptable and are so musically and physically intelligent. You can kind of throw anything at them.
You mentioned that this is music that you grew up with. I think we're in the same boat, but it's hard to believe it was 50 years ago that it was the Summer of Love, and that music is really just very comfortable to listen to. I'm wondering, is it... That era was idealized. The Summer of Love is kind of like put in a picture frame and looked at as something really ideal, but the reality was something quite different. But the music is what I think ties everything together. I'm wondering if your approach to the work that you're doing here, is it more idealized in that kind of positive spirit of the Summer of Love?
I definitely did not want to create a sentimental trip back through time. I think there's going to be a lot of that happening this year. I don't want to make any work where I don't feel like I have something to contribute from my own experience. It was such a rich period in history that dictated what happened in the period subsequently. I really deal with a lot of conflicting themes about the time and the work. I mean, what was very opening and also a challenge was that anyone you talk to who was there has their own opinion about what it meant, and sometimes drastically conflicting perspectives. Some people feel that it was an exploration solely about free love. Other people think it was, the path to enlightenment through access to LSD. Certain people think it was solely a protest about the Vietnam War. Some people were just there to have a good time. And, it depends on who you ask, and it depends on where they were and where they were in their own life. That gives me a lot of license to kind of focus on the things that I want to and the things that I most respond to personally.
So what will we see on stage for this?
I... I take it as a really poetic narrative. There's certainly not a linear narrative that carries us through, but it is a real journey through themes that relate to the happening of it and people coming together to explore an idea. Themes of protest, the exploration of LSD as a path toward enlightenment, the search for religion and a higher power, and then ultimately finding the feeling of presence and spiritual opening through being in this very moment, and that being a very personal journey and something that we all have to arrive at on our own.
What are we going to be seeing for costuming of the era, or something generic?
Definitely not generic. The costume and set designer for the piece, her name is Sandra Woodall, and she's been a collaborator of mine longer than any other designer that I've worked with. And she was here. She was here in the Summer of Love, and that's great because she shares my same purpose and aesthetic, and that we didn't want to just create some sweet flashback, that we really wanted to explore these themes in a deeper way. So she was a great collaborator in really pushing to not just do a historical representation. In the meantime, she could always make sure we're still grounding it in authenticity and making sure that any reference was truly referencing something. So, you know, we start in the costuming. There's a start from the typical clothing of the era. But then kind of an opening up and a stylization of it and making it, seeing it through a more contemporary lens.
You write in some of your blog posts that you're kind of PO'd at yourself about your own sense of idealism and how that can be sometimes corrupted. And there's a bit of anger about maybe your sense of idealism can't come through. Are we going to see any of that in this work, or is it completely removed?
You're going to see some of everything in that, you know, I don't outline every moment of the piece and then just simply hope the dancers can execute it. I tend to stir up a lot of information surrounding the idea of the piece and what I want to explore. And then I use those ideas just kind of as a toy chest to work very improvisationally in the studio. And the reason I do that, and when I say improvisationally, I mean that I'm myself making up those movements in the moment. Because I like that they come from that exact moment.
So is there an element of improvisation on the part of your dancers as part of this work, or is it all very strictly worked out?
No. No, I mean, I'm very exacting in what I'm looking for. My point of that is that I am not planning the movement ahead of time. When I come in the studio, I want it to be of the moment, because I think it'll be the most honest and contentful because of that. And so in the process of doing that, you know, all the things that you ask about will be, to some extent, intrinsic to the movement. And, you know, my hope in the end is to create a piece that has a lot of very deliberate content in it, but that the audience necessarily has to get it from my perspective. The content is all there, but I welcome people to imprint their own life experience in the way that they see it and let the piece be what it is the way that they see it. And I think that's a really special part of dance, and that the audience is really an equal partner in it. You know, there's always an abstraction, no matter how literal the work is. It's always simply told through movement, and so it creates this wonderful Rorschach that anyone can imprint their own life on, and that result will be true.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be not only interesting visually, but of course the music is going to really make for a spectacular experience for this part of the Smuin Ballet's presentation. Looking at the larger Trey McIntyre project, based in Boise, Idaho, you're a Kansas boy. Why and how did you end up in Boise with the project?
I started my company as a summer pickup company, and so my dancers would be from all over the place. We did that for 3 years and picked up momentum very quickly. The company was a big success right out of the gate, and so, you know, made the decision to go to a full-time company fairly early and had the luxury of living where I wanted to. And so really, I think a lot of people assumed, okay, you have a successful dance company, of course you're going to base yourself in New York. That's a sign of success. But I didn't really care about that. And
you might get lost there, too.
I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, I think you can judge that from the company's success and how well we did. It wasn't that. It had nothing to do with being a big fish in a small pond or anything like that. It was in making a dance company, which is such a huge endeavor, what are we contributing, really? Like, what? Why go to all this effort besides my own quest as a choreographer or vanity, even? And I think you have to really think about, what are you contributing to the world around you to do something that big? And there's such a big divide between, you know, we're in such a red state, blue state zone right now, and nowhere is that more apparent than in support for the arts. And I think, you know, if smaller communities don't have a regular diet of arts that are great, then why would there be support? Then it's just something nice that you're supposed to do. And so I thought, let's base the company somewhere where there isn't the developed dance community that San Francisco or New York has. And let's see if we can become an intrinsic part of the fabric of that city. So it was an experiment to see if that would work. And I have to say, like, it was a huge success very quickly. And the city embraced us like the football team. And, you know, so many naysayers said, you know, you're going to go, if you're not in New York, you're going to disappear from the map. But I mean, we had 2 full-page stories in the New York Times in the first 2 years about what a unique model this was. So I have to say, in the end, it was nothing but a benefit to the company.
And it's so much more beneficial to be a part of a community rather than just, you know, coming and doing your thing and then leaving. And is that part of your business model that's been so widely praised? Is that what makes you different from some other dance project? Or what is it, the business model, that is being so widely widely praised?
That's certainly one part of it, and another is very deliberately creating a context for audiences. I think simply having the expectation that someone in American culture can walk into a dance performance and not feel stupid because they don't have any reference point, I think that's unrealistic. And I think it's the job of arts organizations to create that context. So we spent a great deal of our time, not only in the Boise community, but everywhere that we traveled, doing that. You know, lots of different things. And most of it had to do with accessibility, to like actually really getting in there and seeing what it is. One of my favorite things that we did was called Make a Ballet, where we'd invite people into a room and I'd choreograph a ballet right in front of them and just show something from nothing. And I mean, people's minds exploded over it, because I think people don't really think this, but on some level, the sense is dancers just show up and dance, you know, and they don't realize what a meticulous process it is, and what the physics are of that, what the organization and what the athleticism is of that. And then people can see that and then ask questions, and then they develop relationships with the people in the room. And you know, we saw in Boise that spread like wildfire really quickly. And then suddenly people had opinions about it. And I'll tell you, I had some of the most interesting conversations with audience members and patrons about dance in Boise, Idaho, much more interesting than ones I might have in New York. Like, very thoughtful questions and opinions about things. I'll give you a great example of that. You know, one of the weirdest pieces I made for the company was called 10 Pin Episodes, and I made it because someone donated 200 bowling pins to the company. I thought, I'm going to do something with this. So the piece was really out there. And so our great mayor David Beter, he stopped me on the street and he said, that bowling pin piece, he said, you know, when I first saw it, I didn't like that. He said, but you know what? Now it's my favorite piece. And you know why? He said, because I haven't stopped thinking about it. And every time I come back to it, I have a new idea about it. I have a new question about it. And he was really like showing me his gratitude. And I think that's so indicative of the spirit that we engendered in that community.
Well, keep doing what you're doing, and we look forward to your return to San Francisco in whatever way you can.
Great. Thanks so much.
Choreographer Trey McIntyre. For more information about Smeelin' Ballet's Dance Series 2 in Mountain View this weekend, Walnut Creek next, San Francisco from the 19th to 28th, visit smeelinballet.org. Little mamas and papas to celebrate this summer of love here now with one of my favorite people here at KLW, Ashley Ann Craigbaum. Hey, Ashley Ann.
Shucks. Thanks, David. Hi. And hey, everyone out there. Before we get into BBC News Hour, I just want to say how much I appreciate Open Air, the work that you do, David, the work that your team does. And listening to that interview about Encounter just blew me away. And thank you for bringing programming that's really about what's happening with live performance here in the Bay Area. There's not another show like it that I listen to. And if you feel the same way, if open air really brings new perspectives for you and what's going on in the live world here in the Bay Area, call us 800-525-9917. Have your vote be heard. Let us know that you want to become a member of KALW or renew your membership. You know, we won't bug you in the mail, give you the pesky letters to renew if you take care of it right now. 800-525-9917.
Thank you for that plug. You know, Open Air is a spontaneous program. We do it live, it warts and all. It still is an in-depth view at some of the things that are happening here in the performing arts. 800-525-9917 during this NPR update, followed by news from the BBC. Thanks for being with us.